Folks, this is Screen Watching. My name's Dan Barrett. I'll be joined in just a moment by Simon Foster. Let's open this week's podcast with a question. When it comes time to do the US remake of Zone of Interest, will the film star Will Ferrell? The answer will be yes.
This is not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Hey guys, this is Screen Watching. My name is Dan Barrett, joined by Simon Foster. Simon Foster, are you looking forward to the US remake of Zone of Interest?
Oh, well, I love Will Ferrell in anything, so I'm all for him playing Camp Commander Hess. He'll be just terrific in that part. Hello, Screen Watchers all around the world. I hope you're having a good time. There will be no insipid banter straight off the top of this show. We have a very tight schedule to maintain this week. We have a deep dive as our intermission, the Dan Barrett Special Eyewitness News Special Report coming at you about the launch of Hubble, and he'll talk more on that later. Zone of Interest is in cinemas, finally. I saw it like 6 months ago, but I'll try and remember how much I loved it. Drive Away Dolls, House of Ninjas, Estonia on SBS. Look, we're very excited. Shall we just dive straight in, Dan?
No, because I want some insipid banter to begin with. So, okay, so we've got Will Ferrell starring in Zone of Interest. Who's his female lead? Because I think that's really important. Wow.
Amy Poehler.
Okay, so I'm on a very similar sort of wavelength here. I was thinking, yes, I know that they've had a turn together before, but I think maybe this is the reunion we're really looking for. What about Jenna Fischer from The Office and also Blades of Glory?
If there's someone I think of in the US industry who's Sandra Hula, through and through, it's Jenna Fischer. That's very true. She's a fine dramatic actress. Are we being too light about one of the more serious films of this year? Maybe we shouldn't be this light about it, but you're right. There's probably going to be a US remake. You know what I did watch through the week? And this is the insipid banter part I was telling you about, was the film Downfall, which was the story of Hitler's final days in his bunker. Now, I didn't see this upon release. It's just one of those ones that slipped through the net. I think I was having a baby at the time or someone I knew. And it's an extraordinarily powerful film. I'm going through a bit of a World War II sort of retrospective phase at the moment. So it was a great film.
Not to be confused with Downhill, which was Will Ferrell's remake of Force Majeure.
Force Majeure. See how we came full circle then? We should get another review, Dan.
It stinks.
Okay, Simon, I think we're going to do one feature review this week and we're giving it all the seriousness of which it deserves. Oh, gosh, how do we do serious, Simon? I'm not comfortable with this at all. But we are going to be taking a look at the film. Sorry, I'm just even lost as to how we approach this. It's called Zone of Interest.
This one has been doing the festival circuit and certainly the awards season blathering on. The Zone of Interest is Jonathan Glazer's concentration camp story, and by that I mean it's the story of the Auschwitz commander Rudolf Hess and his wife Hedwig, who are building for themselves a beautifully bourgeois middle-class life. And what everybody wants who lives a bourgeois middle-class life is to be close to work. And he couldn't be any more closer to work. This house, the beautiful garden, his beautiful family are all being constructed right literally at the to the one side of the Auschwitz concentration camp. This film is filled with the sounds, the minutiae of concentration camp life, but all on the fringes of Hess's and his wife's existence in this idyllic sort of abode. You are conscious of it going on all the time, the extermination of the Jewish people just meters from their front door. But what you're witness to is them trying, or them quite easily maintaining, a life of distance despite the proximity to which their house is. And in that, you have a film which there's been a lot of talk about the banality of evil and what it means to what these people had to sort of believe in their own existence to the extent that they could lock out and close out the horrors that were happening just meters from their home. It's also about what you're willing to lock out of your lives to achieve your middle class status. So there's a little bit of a contemporary thematic sort of line in this where you, where we learn of just how evil the bourgeois and the middle class and the upper middle class values can be in terms of what they're willing to shut out of their lives to maintain that existence. Either way you look at it, it's a pretty extraordinary film and a pretty extraordinary vision from Glazer, who's a director that hasn't made a lot of films, but the ones he's made, like Sexy Beast, like Under the Skin. Was it Under Skin? Under the Skin, the one with Scarlett Johansson. Yeah, really unique visions. He came from a advertising and music video background, which isn't always, you know, breeding ground for great directors, although you've got the likes of Fincher and now Glazer's doing amazing work. So, yeah, The Zone of Interest is absolutely worthy of all the praise it's getting, but it is a tough and at times a little bit confusing watch. He makes some sort of artistic flourishes which sort of caught me a bit off guard, dream sequences and black and white sequences that are sort of inserted somewhat randomly that I'm keen to hear your thoughts on. But, yeah, it's easily one of the best films of the year.
Yeah, so look, I'm certainly not disputing the quality of the movie, because I think that just from concept alone and execution of it is both incredibly strong. Apologies for the word execution in that one. That was certainly not intended. Where I struggled a little bit with this movie, I struggled in a couple of points with it. So I only caught this one yesterday afternoon. It's pretty fresh in my mind. It's a very difficult watch in that you... At no point do you ever go into the concentration camp. It is all held from outside the walls of it. But what you're really confronted with is people who, and I don't think that, like, nobody's made a conscious decision to block out the horrors taking place on the wall, literally on the other side of the family backyard. But there is obviously a cultural imperative to see themselves as superior, and the Jewish people is not even really a consideration of humanity. I was trying to use an analogy then, but I'm not going to. It's just sort of too horrific. What I found was the choice to even follow people like this is to imbue them with a sense of humanity that I'm not sure they necessarily deserve. I completely understand how an entire nation of people were brought along culturally to find this permissible. But at the same time, it's not like this film celebrates it, but in a way, this film almost gives an excuse. You can kind of see how these are such flawed people, and you can see their humanity despite the very large psychological borders that they've placed up. And just while watching these people over the course of the almost 2-hour runtime, it was just something really uncomfortable about giving them that level of humanity, which I just really didn't care for. So that was always on my mind while I was watching it. Okay. That said, it is an interesting portrait of humanity, and I do wonder whether or not the points of this would have been better pushed forward if it was maybe a shorter runtime. By the time you sort of hit that 90-minute mark, it's kind of, you're sort of seeing the same idea being repeated through. It's not quite a repetition, but like there's nothing sort of new being introduced. You're still just watching humanities making compromises for, you know, just the horrific activities that are involved in. So you're still seeing that take place. I kind of feel a shorter runtime would still get that same point across. But then also the film, it kind of feels padded out by what's almost a fairy tale story of a nearby girl who's coming to give treats of sugar and other food parcels to the prisoners who are working in the field sort of around the camp. And I don't really understand why that was needed. In a way, it almost felt as though that was kind of a palate cleanser to allow you to return back to the horrors of the rest of the movie. And I don't know, like maybe I've missed some sort of artistic statement being made there, but it just kind of felt like there was almost an excuse for the movie being told every like 20 or 30 minutes just to break you away. And maybe we shouldn't be broken away from that kind of a story. And I don't know, that sort of rankled with me a little bit. And there's a very end sequence where we cut away from the movie to jump forward to the modern time and see people cleaning up the current museum of Auschwitz, and then it jumps back in time to Hess or Hoss. I didn't really quite understand what was being said there explicitly, and I don't know, it was just too much of a leap for me to be able to really quite get it. And yeah, it was just interesting, jarring those aspects.
That's an interesting point, that I interpreted that sequence where they jump forward to the cleaning of the graveyard and the cleaning of the memorial. From what I remember, and I should point out, I saw this back in September last year, so it's coming back to me in bits and pieces. I saw that as the modern German society coming to terms with the horrors and respecting the dead. That was the only way I could interpret that sequence. I do want to address just the point you made about portraying these sort of people. And at the top of the show, I mentioned I watched Downfall, and I realized I probably avoided watching Downfall for many, many years, and maybe even at the time of its release, certainly at the time of its release, was because I didn't want to see that sort of study and that sort of humanity and any kind of deeply profound interpretation of Hitler on screen. Having watched it just last week, I now see that it in painting a portrait of Hitler, it was a film that pointed out all his flaws, pointed out, yes, he's just a man who was given opportunity to fulfill horrific visions and horrific intentions. And the separation he was able to make from his own morality and his own sense of what was right into these beliefs. And I think that's what Glazer is trying to do in portraying these people and the ambivalence they can have, the cruel and the horrible ambivalence they can have towards their intentions towards the Jewish people. So I think it's important that we see that these are just normal people who are caught up in an ideology, because I think that's what's impacting the world in such a horrible way, maybe now more than ever since the Holocaust and what Hitler and his Germany did back then. So it's certainly a film that inspires discussion and interpretation, and there are a million different stories that could be told out of the horrors of the Holocaust, and this is one of them, and I think it's told in a really profound and obviously at times horrifying way. So
yeah, run, don't walk to see Zone of Interest.
I don't know. We've gone this whole review without mentioning Sandra Hüller, the actress who is the sort of the it girl at the moment with this and with Anatomy of a Fall in cinemas. So she is an extraordinary actress, and she is very powerful and talented actress. So it's great to see her rise to the fore, have her moment in the spotlight, because she's great in this and in Anatomy of a Fall, obviously.
Yeah, wildly different roles.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, I think it's the mum from Freaks and Geeks that'll be playing the mother in Zone of Interest, the US remake, only because both of them have a very strong...
I can't remember who that was.
What, the mum from Freaks and Geeks?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's... gosh, what's her name? Name's forgotten. Becky Ann. It's not Becky Gelke. There was no readings or... No.
We'll get to that. By the end of the show, we'll know who played the mum in Freaks and Geeks. We will be the only film reviewers in the world who bring up Freaks and Geeks in our Zone of Interest review.
I know, and that's really what makes the difference. This is what makes us the valuable resource that we are. Becky Ann Baker.
All right, okay. I'll have to get a photo of her up. All right, Dan Barrett, let's go into intermission.
Like the mum from Zone of Interest. Okay, Simon, we're only doing one feature interview this week. We are going to dive instead straight now to the intermission.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's intermission time.
So, Dan Barrett, for perhaps the second time in a couple of weeks, we're having a Dan Barrett deep dive, because we're really in your zone here. This week, Foxtel released a very exciting new phase in American broadcasting, or is it? We're in Australian broadcasting, or is it? We're going to find out from your point of view. It's called Hubble. And I'm reading this from the Foxtel press release. Australia's newest transformative TV technology is set to change the entertainment experience for the better for millions of Australians. Hubble is TV and streaming made easy. Now, you got an invite to the launch this week. I didn't get an invite. I don't know what's going on there. But you were able to be front and center for the presentation at the Foxtel launch of this new technology. I'm turning this segment over to you to give us some indication of what Hubble is and what are your thoughts on it. Go.
Okay, the two quibbles I'd have from that media release are phrases like transformative and millions. But let's backtrack a little bit. So, look, basically what Hubble is, very simply, it's a set-top box or a TV. We'll think about it as a set-top box to begin with. Plug it into your TV the same way as an Apple TV or Amazon's Fire Stick or any of those sorts of devices, Chromecast with Google TV. Plug it into your TV, then suddenly there's a brand new operating system that lets you stream all your TV shows. So it's all based on partnerships. So it's not an open app store in the same way that Apple TV has, where you could be any TV provider. You can build your own app, and as long as it's approved by Apple, you're up in the app store. It's not like that at all. It's all based on these partnerships that Foxtel have struck. So at launch, you've obviously got all the Foxtel apps, which include things like Kayo, Binge, the new Lifestyle app, and also Flash, their news linear streamer. Netflix, Stan, Paramount Plus, I think will be a few weeks before it makes it on there, but it's definitely coming. All your free-to-air apps, so ABC, iView, 7 Plus, 9 Now, 10 Play, SBS On Demand, they're all there. YouTube will be on there. I feel I'm missing one or two others. I think Sky News has got its app on there. I don't think it's necessarily just within Flash. Anyway, so you've got like your major Australian streaming services all sort of sitting in there. Basically, the idea, the ethos of this is that they want to try to make streaming as simple as possible and give a fair bit of control back to the subscriber. Okay, so ultimately what it means is that, yeah, and like that's fine. And like you go through the interface and what it is, it's a curated collection of programs. So there's a curated home screen, which just like if you go to say Netflix or Binge or anything, you'll see that top level of, you know, new releases and comedies and films starring guys named Barry and, you know, all that kind of thing. So depending on what's happening at any given moment, like that'll update throughout the day. So, you know, a few weeks ago, there was the meme online about how often do men think about ancient Rome? And so if you went on to Binge like that afternoon, like there was a row of films of, have you been thinking about ancient Rome? And it's like just a whole bunch of movies from Rome. So it's like just fun, human curated stuff. Yeah. So you've got that kind of approach to it. And then like there's a page for movies. And so it'll do the same thing with movies and it'll break it out and bring every subscription service you're subscribed to through Hubble. Is all there to watch. So it'll be movies, if you're in a movie section, it'll be movies mixed in from SBS On Demand, next to stuff from Stan, next to Netflix things, next to whatever, and it's all just in one place. And it depends what you subscribe to as well. It's not going to show you things that you're not a subscriber of. So it's a really sort of good human-centered approach to do all this. But there's two really big glaring issues with it. Okay, in that one, I actually think that as a product, if I only subscribe, like, look, let's say I'm only a subscriber to Netflix and maybe Paramount Plus, and I occasionally dabble with the free-to-air streamers. So maybe I'm a big iView viewer and watch the occasional SBS On Demand thing. And I've got that, and that never changes over the course of a couple of years. I would be very happy with this product. Okay, and sorry, just give like other sort of benefit that it has. Your services. So in that scenario, I've got my Netflix, Stan, and Paramount Plus. I can go to a page and it will show me all the things that I'm paying for and how much I pay for that each month. Okay. If I subscribe to three different services and have the billing handled by Hubble, because they'll take care of the billing for you for each of the services coming through, they'll knock $5 off your monthly bill. Okay. Subscribe to 4 services, they'll knock $10 off. Subscribe to 5 services, $15 off. And like, that's a pretty good incentive to bring your billing over to Hubble. But you don't have to bring your billing to Hubble either. You can just log into your apps and do it away from there. But there's an incentive to get Hubble/Foxtel to take care of your billing. And as with all these things, like, they take a little bit of a slice off the top for themselves to, you know, handle
that's
the payments.
That's going to be another deep dive at some point, because that's quite a cut that Foxtel could conceivably take.
Let's get to the rest of the
that's
conversation.
That's another deep dive. Yeah, all right.
That's another deep dive. So I don't think that deep dive is necessarily going to be necessary, because there's two really big problems with the Hubble platform, which is the very first problem, and this is the lesser of the two problems. Talking about the streaming services there, it's all partnerships based on what Foxtel's done. So essentially, each of those companies have signed a deal with Foxtel. They're handling their billing, whatever. But it means that, let's say I'm also a subscriber to BritBox for my British dramas. Let's say I want Shudder for horror films. Let's say I want Hayu for reality programming. If I want to sign up to any of those, Foxtel haven't signed partnerships, at least not yet. So they're not on the box. So ultimately, if I want to access any of those services and are important to me, I still need another bit of hardware to be able to access anything outside of the walled garden of Hubble. Okay, and that's actually a pretty big problem. For a lot of people, it's not such an issue. But also, I mean, what happens if 2 years from now, Foxtel end up in like a little bit of a beef with Netflix, for example, and Netflix like, oh, well, you know, let's just end this partnership. We don't really want you handling our billing anymore. We've had a change of strategy with, you know, whatever. All sorts of things could happen, which could end up that sort of severing that relationship. Then suddenly you've lost Netflix from the platform, possibly. Okay, like, there's just no real control there. And like, that's kind of, you can accept all of that, okay, if it was a situation where this is one of the few devices out on the market that can do that. But it's not. I mentioned at the top, you've got Amazon Fire Sticks, you've got Apple TV, you've got Chromecast with Google TV. You've got every TV now has smart TV functionality. And that's been the case now for like at least the last 7 or 8 years. I did a bit of a quick Google, well, a quick sort of search on the JB Hi-Fi website, rather. I thought, well, what's the cheapest TV I could possibly get? And it's a TV that costs $199. It's like 32 inches or something. I can't think of the name of the brand. It's like F-Fox or something. It's not quite right, but it's a brand I'd certainly never heard of before. Okay. Well, it wasn't even like a, you know, dodgy sort of play on a name sort of thing. It was just blatantly some sort of just cheap TV. $199 comes with Android TV on board. Okay. So like, wow. Even the cheapest of TVs now, I'm looking at my computer monitor right now. It's a Samsung monitor that has smart TV functionality in it. Like, I can stream all sorts of things through it. And that's pretty common now for a lot of monitors that you're buying. Anything with a stream has smart functionality. So ultimately, there's nothing that Foxtel is really bringing with this that is such a compelling lure that you'd be willing to adopt that versus one of the many other devices in your life that already has all of this choice. Now, sorry, can I just give one quick? Sorry, can I give one quick sort of aspect?
Yeah.
What I just said then is based on this false pretense that people would be making a decision to go, oh, well, I'm just going to push aside the hardware I've got right now and buy this new box. Yeah. That's not what it is. And that's not how people make these decisions. The decision gets made next time they need to upgrade their hardware. Okay. And so they really need a compelling case that next time someone's upgrading their hardware, they'll go for that. But when they're making that purchasing decision, I think lots of people may be lured by, at least when it comes to, it's not just a plug-in device they've got. There's actually like a 55-inch and a 65-inch TV that they're selling. And the TVs are reasonably okay looking. They're mid-tier performers. So like, I'm sure that if I don't really care about like getting the best picture quality, I'm not really desperately after like the technical specificity. Instead, I'm just looking for a TV that'll do the job, that looks good in my lounge room. Here, they may have a slight competitive advantage in that the colors, the TVs all come in like interesting, like actually fairly elegant colors, and they all look sort of fairly nice. So I can imagine people being drawn to the TV for that. But when they get to that experience on the internals of the TV, I think they may just find it to be a slightly frustrating experience. Sorry, Simon. Question without notice. Let's go.
Question without notice, and this may sort of play into the fact I'm a little bit of a smart TV Luddite and can't and don't know all the tech like you do, but when I turn on my Foxtel box and I scan across the top choices of where I want to go. I have an apps option. I press that and Netflix, SBS On Demand, iView, Prime, they all come up. What's the inherent difference between what I'm doing by pressing one of those apps and getting access to Netflix through Foxtel and what they're offering here?
You'll still be able to do that, but the difference is that the main – so you said to do that, you go to your top navigation bar, you scroll over a couple, go to apps. So apps is what, maybe like four or five options along in your navigation bar?
Well, our apps is right at the end. Click on that and we get about 14 or 15 different options come up within that app.
But like in the navigation bar, you're scrolling past like movies and TV shows and news and whatever else to get to it. Okay, so let's say that that's five different clicks of your remote control to get over to the apps. That's an extra click to get into it. So let's say you're up to six clicks. You're in the app then, and then you're starting to make your viewing decisions. So, you know, that's when the scrolling begins. Ultimately, by pulling together all of your content, you're making that decision without having to go six clicks over, seven clicks, eight clicks. You're doing that just from your front screen. In theory, if their curation's any good, you're finding something you probably want to watch right there on that front screen. Or if you want to get really specific, one click over on movies, two clicks over on TV. You know, it's just a quicker experience. And also, it pulls together everything. So you're not going in and out of apps to try to find something. Whether that's worth upgrading.
So what was the second drawback you mentioned?
Well, the second drawback was the fact that everybody's got one of these devices already in their houses. Like, we've had Stan and Netflix in our lives since 2015. Smart TVs were already around then. You have to think that as anyone who's interested in streaming TV, at some point over the last 9 years, they've probably gotten some sort of device to stream their TV, whether that's a TV that has smart TV functionality, or maybe they're like me with a TV that is still just kicking on and will not die. God damn you, Sony television. Why will you just not break? I don't have smart TV functionality in that. But look, I've got an Apple TV that I've plugged into it, so, you know, no difference there. And like over the last 9 years, if I wanted to stream TV, I've probably done that. I've probably spent the like fairly expensive Apple TV because that's at the higher end of the market. But maybe I've just spent like the $69 to buy a Amazon Fire Stick. Maybe I've spent like the $89 to get a Chromecast with Google TV in it. Like, there's just so, like, almost every TV now has some sort of smart functionality to it. It just feels so far into the cycle that it's not an exciting product by any means. People look at it saying, well, I don't need this. But the thing's going to be when people make a purchasing decision, are they going to upgrade and think about hardware as a potential replacement for whatever hardware they've got? Because the power supply
question.
But they just have to look at it going, well, is this something that serves all the apps that I want? And I don't know. I think that for some viewers, they're going to be okay, but there's going to be some viewers who get really frustrated with the experience when that new streaming service launches, when one of them drops away, when suddenly they're not quite getting everything they want from a streaming experience. They're going to be really super frustrated.
All right. Dan Barrett, an expert deep dive into the new Hubble Foxtel's interface update. What do you call it? Is that what it's even called, or streaming service manager?
So the way they call it is Hubble is the set-top box. They refer to it as the puck, or at least they were during the presentation, because it's like a hockey puck size thing. A puck makes no sense in an Australian context at all, really. They call it the puck. So the Hubble is the box. The Hubble Glass is the TV, and none of them are on sale yet. When they are on sale, the Hubble Glass will be exclusive to Harvey Norman, which will be a deal breaker for some people. You've got that, and then the Hubble itself will be available in Harvey Norman's and JB's. No on-sale dates yet. I can tell you the Hubble will be $99, and the TVs will be $15.95 and $16.95, based on if you want 55-inch or 65-inch. That price is slightly higher than other TVs of the same size, but it has a built-in soundbar. Back in my day, we called them speakers, but, you know, that's neither here nor there. But it's got a proper soundbar that's built into it. And you can see it, like, at the bottom. Like, it's a full soundbar you'd be buying. And if you would be buying, say, if you wanted to buy a similar kit, you can buy, like, a similar sort of specs Samsung TV for, like, $1,300. But if you're buying the soundbar to go with it, because the speakers on TVs just suck, you'll be spending like $300 or $400 anyway. So that's kind of where it gets that comparative pricing.
And I know the final question that everyone wants to know is, did you meet any of the Real Housewives of Sydney at the Foxtel launch? Because I know there was a bevy of celebrities there, the Australian Idol people, Hamish and Andy. Did you shake hands? Did you bump shoulders with any of the Foxtel celebrity brigade?
Well, what was okay, so this is kind of interesting. The actual presentation itself, Foxtel, despite the fact that it's Foxtel behind the bubble, they took the Foxtel out of the equation entirely through that presentation. All the celebrities that were brought up on stage were pretty much people who were from other networks. So it was like your Adam Leals from SBS, and there were a couple of sports people. There was one guy who was an AFL player. There was another woman who was from the NRLW. Is that the name of the women's league?
Yeah.
Yeah. It is. Yeah. So you had people like that, and then it was just like rando celebrities from all over the place. They did have some Real Housewives of Sydney there. I recognize them because, look, I've never seen the show, but I have seen Plastic Surgery.
You didn't lie.
So they were very easy to recognize.
All right. Okay. That's a good night out.
I only spoke to one celebrity other than notable celebrities like your wife. The only celebrity I really said hello to was one Richard Wilkins.
Wow, interesting. Look at you hanging out with Dickie Wilkins. All right, Hubble is in stores. Do we have a launch date yet?
I hung out with Richard Wilkins. Let's not go that far, but I did say hey, and he said hey.
Now, you don't want to get into that contest from what I've heard. All right, Hubble's is Foxtel's new set-top box on its way very soon. Let's move on with the show. Dan Barrett, what else have you been watching?
Look, so during the week, this actually debuted late last week, but we had to record a little bit early, so I wasn't able to see it in time. It was a new Netflix drama called House of Ninjas. Simon, when it comes to House of Ninjas, two things sort of come to mind for me immediately. House of Ninjas, give me a house of pancakes, maybe. I'm not so sure that I necessarily need a full house of ninjas. But also, I really like ninjas. I'll watch anything with a ninja in it, whether it's a turtle or like...
We have reviewed a lot of ninja-related content over the years, I must admit.
Yeah, and like, it's... Who doesn't love ninjas? So look, the premise of this one is that it's the modern era. There is a family who are the descendants of Hattori Hanzai. People would know that name if you've seen Kill Bill. It was a Hattori Hanzai sword. Okay. You look confused. Okay, that's a big plot point in that. Yeah, but anyway, Hanzo is actually like a real ninja. Existed many, many years ago. He's a famed swordsman. So this series is Richard Wilkins style. I mean, he really was the Richard Wilkins of, I don't know what century he was around. I was going to say feudal Japan, but I'm not sure that's actually true. Look, so you've got these family and they're the current sort of generation from that family lineage. It's a family where they've kind of fallen out of the world of ninjuring. About 6 years ago, there'd been some sort of an incident, and as a family, they've made a collective decision to run away from that. So the family business is a brewery, and the patriarch of the family, he's sort of thrown himself into that business, and as far as he's concerned, he's just a businessman running his failing brewery. He can get government assistance, but he keeps on saying no to that. And it becomes apparent why. And the reasoning is because within the Japanese government, there is a, I'm going to call it clandestine, but I don't know if you're clandestine when you've only got three employees. There's the Bureau of Ninja Management, I think they call themselves. And it's the government department that's dedicated.
Dan Barrett deep dive.
Well, it's a department that's there looking after the ninjas. So these guys are really keen to get the family back into the art of ninjuring. The family are like, no, I don't want anything to do with that. Within the family, you've got mother, father, teenage kids, but I think once the girl's still a teenager, the son's like in his early 20s. The son works as a vending machine refiller. So he drives around at night, filling vending machines. He falls for this girl.
So it's a basically, it's a family drama or a group of ninjas. Okay.
I mean, pretty much. And so from a premise perspective, that sounds pretty interesting. Okay.
Sure.
But these things are always execution dependent. And while definitely episode one has two sequences in it, which I think really elevate it and gave me a lot of hope that this could be more. The opening title sequence is a, generic-ish, like, premium drama opening title sequence. But instead of being sort of Japan, they play the song Our House over the top of it. And I'm like, okay, this is kind of interesting and tonally just a little bit sort of unexpected. Like, I'm willing to go with this. And then it kind of settled into what it is. And I'm like, it's just kind of a bit of a generic film, a series that isn't really quite living up to the premise. And then they reach the end where it's a sequence and, again, slightly generic, but it's a fight scene that takes place in a nightclub, which, can we maybe not have fight scenes in nightclubs anymore? Haven't we seen that? I think we're kind of good for those sorts of things. Yeah. But anyway, this is one of those. And visually, it got a bit exciting. And I was like, okay, like this sort of makes good compared to the action sequences we'd seen previously in the program. But then you start getting to the second episode and all those sort of little visual flourishes just aren't really there for it. And it just really just fell into just going through the motions. If you like ninja stuff.
Is this a US series or is this one of the Netflix Asian sector pickups or?
So this is definitely of Japan, of Netflix Japan. Okay. Guy who ran it, his name is actually Dave something or other. I'm going to call him Dave Bird. I'm not sure that's his name though. It's something similar to that. Very Western name, but from the little I could work out about him, he seems like he's a man of Western background who's been living in Japan for most of his life. So it's, kind of feels a little bit awkward from a name perspective, but I think authentic enough. It'll satisfy like casual viewing needs, but it's certainly not something you should be running to, whether I in stealth mode or like.
wearing the black balaclava as ninjas do. That's a good look for some people. House of Ninjas on Netflix as we speak. Ask me the question, Dan Barrett.
Simon, ASL question mark. No, what else have you been watching?
Thank you, sir. Two, very quickly, I want to mention at over on SBS On Demand is a series called Estonia. A little bit of a backstory to this, so indulge me. On my trip to the Scandinavian region with my beautiful wife, we visited a museum of wrecks, which looked at the centuries of shipping disasters which had befallen the region. We know how to give each other a good time when we travel, so we go to places like this. One of the most moving and potent and powerful moments of my life, quite frankly, was listening to a recording of the two ships that responded to the Mayday call from the ferry Estonia when it started to take on water in the Baltic Sea back in 1994. These were real life recordings between the people, the bridge on the Estonia and the two other ships that were racing to help as it began to sink. Very quickly, the Estonia's radio connection stopped and the ships began to arrive on the scene to find what would ultimately become the worst maritime disaster in Finnish history. This series on SBS On Demand, just called Estonia, recounts not only the details of that ferry sinking and uses those radio broadcasts and that radio communication sequence to chilling effect, but it also looks at the investigation afterwards and how three different countries, Sweden, Estonia and Finland, tried to blame each other for this while not really having too much care or thought for the victims or the victims' families. This is a really gripping bit of television. Maybe my understanding of its backstory helps, but in any regard, it is a really powerful bit of Scandinavian TV that makes for a, if you like a good investigation story, if you like corruption, and if you like human drama, then Estonia is one of the best going at the moment. The other one that I saw this week is a little film that's crept into cinemas, which it shouldn't have crept into cinemas. It should be a much bigger deal. It's called Drive Away Dolls. It's from Universal. This tells the story of two lesbians who, played by the wonderful Margaret Qualley and the equally wonderful Geraldine Viswanath, who find themselves caught up in a caper. They go on a drive in a rented car to find that in the boot is not only a suitcase, the eponymous suitcase, which is central to so many films, but also the head of Pedro Pascal, and that becomes evident as to why the head of Pedro Pascal is in there as you watch the film. And all the craziness that they get into as two hitmen start chasing them on their journey to Tallahassee, Florida. The MacGuffin here, the suitcase and the whole caper movie, is really just sort of the wrapping paper for a really convincing coming out lesbian love story. And Margaret Qualley, well, both of the actresses are wonderful in this, but Margaret Qualley is such an energy, such a force of nature as the very southern, very randy, more outgoing of the two lesbians, that she the chemistry she generates with Geraldine Viswanath is just wonderful. Directed by Ethan Coen, this is really going to test some people's knowledge of cinema, but if you go all the way back to, I think, about 1985, and I have opened the IMDb page here for a film called Crime Wave, was directed by Sam Raimi. It was written by Joel and Ethan Coen and Sam Raimi. Starred people like Brian James, who we know as one of the replicants from Blade Runner. And it was this frantic, over-the-top, pulpy kind of crime story. And it's probably as close as the Coens have come to recreating that sort of energy since Raising Arizona. Now, this is a breakaway. It's not the two Coens. It's only Ethan doing the directing and the co-writing with Trisha Cook. But they've done amazing work here. It's really enjoyable. It's very different to what you expect. There's a whole sort of psychedelic dream sequence in the middle featuring Miley Cyrus that I didn't quite get why it was there, but I was grateful that it was. And it's in a few cinemas, but not too many, which seems... Having seen the film, it's a tough sell. I get that. But I would have liked to have seen the distributor Universal roll the dice a bit harder on this one. It could have found a real audience. So it's called Drive Away Dolls and is in cinemas. And that what else I've been watching, Dan.
The thing is, you should be able to sell, like any movie, it doesn't matter what the film is, you should be able to sell it saying that it's one of the Ethan, it's one of the Coen brothers. Okay, like
have the Coen brothers.
Yeah,
all over it. But I think, you know, this is a financial thing. It's like a minimum of nearly $1 million to launch into the Australian exhibition space. The major exhibition chains, the Hoyts and the Events and the Reddings, they all demand an ad spend of some kind before they book their movies. And I just don't think Universal were willing to roll the dice too much on this one, which is a shame because I think it's gonna find a lot of love, especially amongst... not only amongst, but especially amongst the LGBT community, because it's a really authentic and really lovely portrayal of same-sex romance and same-sex love, and it's and quite graphic in parts as well. So I think it's going to become a cult item, certainly in that regard.
Sorry, just swinging back to that idea, like I don't think that a Coen Brothers movie necessarily needs to play in like your major multiplexes. I think that certainly they've had a few breakout hits, but like they are creatures of the art house. There's a very strong art house audience for them. Like, surely your Palace, your Dendy, your independent cinemas around the country aren't necessarily looking for that same investment of ad spend. Like, there is a way to get a more viral, a more on the ground conversation about a Coen Brothers movie. Like, this is coming out. Like, I was talking to your wife last night, who's a film person, not last night, two nights ago, and I mentioned this movie to her, and she's like, I don't know what this is.
She'd have no idea.
Yeah. And like, if she doesn't know, then there's clearly a problem. Like, you know, she's a film person, but like, this is so under the radar that, you know, even film people don't know this is a movie that's around.
It's very true. You make a good, valid point. I'll take it up with Universal next time I see them. Dan Barrett, please. This day, this week in history. All right, Dan Barrett, let's see if you can put an answer to these questions. February 25, 2019, film review site Rotten Tomatoes implements changes to its site after vicious internet trolls target which film?
I know it was for reasons of misogyny. I want to say it was Captain Marvel.
It was definitely Captain Marvel, yes. The fanboys turned nasty, toxic masculinity and misogyny took over the Rotten Tomatoes site and changes were implemented. February 27, 1996, the launch of the role-playing video game Pocket Monsters Red and Green for Game Boy in Japan introduced the world to what?
So I saw this question on the rundown about 15 minutes ago, and my immediate thought was, because I saw the words red and green, I was thinking that it was maybe the introduction of the Game Boy Color, okay, which could possibly be the answer. But just then when you were saying, I heard Pocket Monsters, I'm like, could this be the introduction of Pokemon?
Beautifully done. Yes.
Yeah.
Nice pivot there. Good job. February 29, 1976, which beloved film classic makes its broadcast TV premiere on the ABC network in the US? First time on television for a...
I don't know. I saw that and I was struggling to think what it would be. Like, immediately I just kind of thought about, like, obvious sort of classics like Citizen Kane or Casablanca. And you do refer to it as a beloved film classic. So, I mean, it's clearly going to be a film of some note. Could it be maybe something like Wizard of Oz?
Ooh, you're very close. Now, I think we've had this discussion before. I don't know if you've seen this film. It's called The Sound of Music.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I haven't seen the movie.
There you go. That was one. Yeah, that's what I remember you saying that years ago when I thought you might have filled that little gap in your viewing hole there. Oh, that's not a... I don't like that term at all.
You know what?
Okay, let's get on to...
Simon, you know why I haven't seen it?
Yeah.
I don't like musicals, so I was just... I just presume it's a musical. You know what?
There's lots of Nazis in it.
That's true. I actually thought it was really, really disappointing because there's this very big trend at the moment of movies disguising that they're musicals in all their publicity trailers. I was very disappointed to find that done the exact same thing with Zone of Interest.
Yeah, yeah. The big dance numbers in that are being very undersold.
I don't think we even mentioned in the review.
Hey, let's go to a birthday quiz.
No. Not happy birthday. No, not that. Please. No. Not happy birthday.
All right. Tough week for a birthday quiz. Not a lot of people like to say that they're born on February 29th. I've got a cousin who was born on February 29th, and he always moved his birthday to February 28th, so he was celebrating it once a year, not once every 4 years. I found that this year that was a little bit tough sort of finding ones. But the clue here is that they have all co-starred with a major Hollywood star, big Hollywood star, for many decades now. February 25, 1976, Rashida Jones. February 28, 1957, John Turturro. February 28, 1948, the beautiful Bernadette Peters. I adore Bernadette Peters. And the great character actor Charles Durning was also born on February 28 in 1923, the late, great Charles Durning. Now, they have all worked, co-starred in a film with this major Hollywood star. This one's going to be a tester because one of them's a bit of a trick. But who might it be, Dan Barrett?
Okay, the fact that you just said one of them's a bit of a trick... Okay, is, and I think I've got this nailed, okay, but I was going to pull you up on this if this is the person I think you're running at here. We're talking Rashida Jones, we're talking John Turturro, we're talking Bernadette Peters, question mark, and Charles Durning. Rashida Jones, this is the name that tipped me off to it. Would the co-star be one Bill Murray, who she appeared in Officer on the Rocks?
Keep going.
Okay, John Turturro was in that movie, was it Cradle Will Rock, with one Bill Murray?
Doing this? Yes, keep going. You've done some research. Go on.
I did research on one of these names, okay, and it was the Turturro. Charles Durning, I know, appeared with one Bill Murray in a little film called Tootsie.
Oh, get out of town. Yes, all right.
Okay. And sorry, when I say I did some research, I did research on two of these names because I saw Rashida Jones and I was like, absolutely Bill Murray, because she has had very few films and TV shows just generally, but let alone ones where she'd start off with someone who would be considered a big Hollywood star. Okay, Charles Durning, I'm like, oh, he absolutely was starred with Bill Murray at some point, and then I just kind of had to run through like Charles Durning things that I knew of and not to see, so... Those two, but I did research the John Turturro. But the Bernadette Peters, okay, like you're going to be saying that he appeared in The Jerk, okay, but he had the same cut from The Jerk, okay, so it doesn't.
You said
he co-starred. big Hollywood film star. One, he's not actually in the movie. Two, it was a cameo appearance and not actually a co-star role. So, Simon, your little thing here, void.
First of all, I did not expect you to do research. That is not what I expect from you, Dan Barrett, so you've caught me completely off guard by there. You're right, Rashida Jones starred with Bill Murray in On the Rocks, the Apple TV movie, and also the special A Very Murray Christmas. Cradle Will Rock is a fantastic film that barely got a release here in Australia. It is available to watch on Disney+. It's the true story of a left-wing troupe led, a theatrical troupe led by Orson Welles, who want to put on this lefty musical drama and about how all the politicians try to close it down. Extraordinary cast, including John Turturro. Charles Durning played Jessica Lange's dad in Tootsie and had some wonderful scenes opposite both Dustin Hoffman as Tootsie and also Bill Murray, who went uncredited in that film because he didn't want it to be seen as a quote-unquote Bill Murray comedy. So he took his name off the credits for that. Yes, and you're right. Now, Bill Murray played a very flamboyantly gay decorator who helped Steve Martin and Bernadette Peters decorate their house in The Jerk in scenes that were cut. Now, it wasn't that he was on screen, but he certainly co-starred opposite them in scenes from The Jerk. It's... No, I could take this to court and I think I'd find a judge in my favour. Yes, look, I know it's willing, it's open interpretation, but it's my segment, so I'm going to claim it.
Challenge accepted. We're going to take this to court. Folks, this has been Screen Watching. I'm going to pursue this legal avenue right now. I'm going to take Simon for all that he's worth. Will it cover legal fees? Probably not. While we do that, folks should check out my newsletter. It's called Always Be Watching. Find that one at alwaysbewatching.com. It covers the big stories in TV, streaming, and film. Comes out every day, keeps you apprised of things. I need to go write it right now. Simon Foster, you do a website and stuff as well. What happens there?
Screen-space.net. You can see things that I write there. Long-form film journalism, the way it was meant to be written by me. And all the screen watching handles as well. Facebook at Screen Watching Podcast. You can email us at screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com. And over on the YouTube channel this week, I had a couple of new interviews go up. Actor Nathan Clark Sapsford from a terrific film called Here Be Dragons, and director Jesse V. Johnson, who directed Olga Kurylenko in Boudica, Queen of War. Wow, that was a lot of letters. They're all over on the YouTube channel. Dan Barrett, thanks for a fun podcast.
Thank you, sir. We'll be back next week with fewer Nazis but more Germans. We'll see you then.